Hello, everybody. How's it going tonight? Cool. If you got a Bible with you, if you want to open up to 1 Kings chapter 15, continuing our study through the kings, the story of the kings. We looked at, we know, just to give you the story so far, the kingdom has divided. We went from being a solitary kingdom under David and Solomon's rule. When Solomon passed away and his son took over, the kingdom was divided. Jeroboam remained as leader and king over the, Rehoboam remained as leader and ruler over the south. Jeroboam became leader of the 10 tribes of the north. And so there's been a civil war, basically, or civil social tensions between them. It's never really, at this point, broken out into outright conflict. But we've been looking at the differences between the kingdoms. Jeroboam went up to the north, and he established his own religion. He forsook God. So he's had prophets come and speak to him. And last week, that's one of the things. His son was sick, and so he went and went to a true prophet of Israel to ask what was going to happen, kind of using him like a psychic hotline. And so the Lord spoke to him and told him that his son was going to go. And then a prophecy was given against him, saying basically that the Lord was going to destroy his whole family because of what he had done by abandoning God and his ways and the religion that God had ordained. And so that's pretty much where we left off last time. We also saw that the southern kingdom had been falling into idolatry as well. So we'll pick up here in chapter 15. We'll start with the first 8 verses. It says, in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abiyam became the king over Judah. And he reigned 3 years in Jerusalem. That's not very long. His mother's name was Maakah, the granddaughter of Absalom. And he walked in all the sins of his father, which he had done before him. His heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem. In other words, he remained in power there by setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and did not turn aside from anything that he had commanded him all the days of his life, except, of course, in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. Now the rest of the acts of Abiyam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Abiyam and Jeroboam. So Abiyam rested with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. Then Asa, his son, reigned in his place. Okay, the wording is cumbersome. It's weird to me that it starts off, in the 18th year of the king of Jeroboam, starts off, you think you're going to be talking about the northern kingdom, but it's not. It's just saying that it's during his 18th year as king. In the southern kingdom, Rehoboam's successor was his son Abiyam. This son of Rehoboam only reigns for 3 years. That's a very, very short amount of time in there, and he's described in quite a negative light. But it's interesting because while it's so negative here, and we're not going to do this tonight, but if you ever get the urge to do it, you can go over to 2 Chronicles chapter 13 and read a little bit more about his life. And he's really not like somebody who was completely outside of any concept of God or anything. I mean, he had clearly had an idea of who God is, and he actually could preach a pretty good sermon, and he does so in 2 Chronicles chapter 13. When the kingdom of the northern kingdoms are arrayed in battle against them, he begins to speak as to why it is he is going to go ahead and fight against his brothers to the north because of the way they'd forsaken God. So he's not as reprobate as Jeroboam, the leader of the north, is. The real problem here is that he's described as someone whose heart isn't loyal to God. Which comes right back to the relational thing again. It always comes back to that. Whenever we're going to go through the scriptures, we're always going to be coming up to that point where we're looking at someone's heart. Where is his heart when it comes to God? And his heart is not tied to God relationally. Preaching a good sermon is one thing. I mean, obviously he does that over in 2 Chronicles. Living his life in loyalty to God is quite another, and that's what God's looking for. He's not looking for someone who can put a good show on at any given moment and look really good or say the right words at any given moment. He's looking for someone whose heart is tied to God, whose heart is passionate for God. And you know, there's a lot of people in this day and age, there's a lot of people that I know who can defend Christianity quite eloquently, who can talk, you know, a lot about in favor of and in defense of Christianity and all of that, but whose values, you know, are not necessarily sharing the values of the kingdom of heaven. I mean, we say it over and over and over again, but that's only because I believe the Word states it over and over and over again. It's a matter of the heart. It's an issue of the heart. Where is our heart? Who do we give our heart to? Obviously, Abiyam had not given his heart to God. So, once again, the text is reminding us here in these first eight verses that it's for David's sake that Abiyam is even a ruler. It's for David's sake that he's there. He's allowed to remain as a ruler. It's the lamp that God has left for David. You look at that and you think about the far-reaching effects of David's loyalty. I mean, think about that. I mean, this is fairly far removed from David himself, and yet because David lived the way he did and because he loved his God the way he loved him, the far-reaching effects of that are is that there's a kingdom there still. And of course, God's got a bigger plan that he's going to work out. So it works, you know, according to God's overall purpose to do this. But I still think, you know, it's one of those things that I think is an important aspect of things that we factor in when we make the choices that we make in life. Because we have no idea how far-reaching those effects are, both positively and negatively. I mean, you know, the heart who is passionate for God and living according to the values of God that he's revealed in his word can have an impact in such a positive way on so many levels with so many lives. There's no such thing as living just to ourselves. There's no such thing as just living an isolated life that I'm just going to, you know, we hear that all the time. I mean, you turn on any daily talk show or anything, or you hear people argue the issues of morality or whatever they argue about, and it always comes back to this concept that, well, what I do in the privacy of my own home or what I do with my life or my body is my business. It has nothing to do with anybody else, but that's really not true. I mean, all of us within the human family are interconnected to some degree and some level, and the choices that we make are always going to have some effect one way or another. Here we see the effects of David's choices to serve God and how far-reaching those effects are. Stuff that I'm sure that he was never aware of, never was conscious was going to ever happen, apart from, you know, the larger and more vague promises that God made to him. Okay, we keep on going. Verse 9. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Asa became king over Judah, and he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His grandmother's name was Maakah, the granddaughter of Abishalom. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as did his father David. Okay, so this is the great-grandson of Solomon. So we're, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is four generations now removed from David. Is that right? If it's the great-grandson, is that four generations or is that five? Either way, it's several generations now removed from David and his heart. You know, he was described as a man whose heart was after God's heart, God's own heart. And yet from David's time, each successive ruler has taken us farther and farther away from that kind of mentality or attitude. Each ruler, from Solomon, his son, down to, you know, his son, and on and on. And so we've been departing farther and farther away from David's loyalty to God. But now we're going to witness a different direction here. So after all these generations, now we've got a son who's born who's moving in a direction back towards God instead of away from him. And we'll notice as this goes on that all the kings of Judah will always be measured by David. You know, he's either going to walk according to David's loyalty and heart towards God, or he's not going to. And that's the measurement that'll be used. David stands as the standard now for the kings of Judah, and they'll measure by him. And so here we see that this guy is, you know, he's in contrast to his father Abiyam, Asa followed in the same type of loyalty to God that David had. He cares about the things of God. And notice also there that the text refers to David as Asa's father, you know, as his father David, which is a curiosity, except that the word in the Hebrew that's used for father actually can carry a different connotation. I mean, it can mean more than just a literal father. It can mean that, but it also is just used oftentimes just as any ancestral designation. You know, this is, he's from this lineage. It doesn't have to be just the literal father or the direct line of a father. So, because like I said, David was actually the great-great-grandfather of Asa, but the similarities are there. Even though they're so far removed generationally, spiritually, they're quite close. They're quite linked. And I think it's even significant that he words it this way. He's his father, because he's behaving more like a son would behave, like Solomon should have behaved, but he didn't. Okay, so verse 12, and then so this is what he does. These are the reforms that he undertakes here. Verse 12, and he says that he had banished the perverted persons from the land, and he removed all the idols that his father had made, and his fathers, plural rather, and he removed Ma'akah, his grandmother, from being queen mother, because she'd made an obscene image of Asherah, and Asa cut down her obscene image and burned it by the brook Kidron. But the high places weren't removed. Nevertheless, Asa's heart was loyal to the Lord all his days. He also brought into the house of the Lord the things which his father had dedicated and the things which he himself had dedicated, silver and gold utensils. So the first thing it says that Asa does was to banish the perverts, which how can you go wrong with that? Again, remember what we're talking about. We want to be clear on this because sometimes, you know, you sit in the context of a New Testament church and right away people begin to think politically or whatever and we start thinking, yeah, that's what this country needs, a band of perverts. And remember that we're dealing with something different. The church is not in that place of governmental rule. The church is not supposed to be in that place. The church is here to promote the values of the kingdom of heaven so that hearts are changed, not to try to bring about political reforms or anything. This is a different dispensation. It's a different context altogether. This is a dispensation when the kingdom was revealed to the kingdom and the nation of Israel. So there was a national thing that was at work here during the time of the law. So what this is talking about, when it says that he banished the perverted persons, what it's talking about is the state-sanctioned pagan prostitutes that were operating in pagan temples that had been erected during that time. Because that's always been associated with the ancient pagan religions. There has always been this class of priests and priestesses who were basically prostitutes. You would go in, make your offering, pay your money, and then you would have sexual relations, and through those sexual relations, you were acting out your worship of said deity, which is what made religions like that really popular. You know, that's just one of those things. Hey, whoop-de-doo. But that wasn't God's plan, never was his plan. And so it's a perversion from the original intent. Worship is supposed to be intimate. Worship of the true God is an intimate and a very close-knit type thing. But it wasn't supposed to be mimicked in the fleshly intimacy that we can know that way. And that's, of course, what was happening in that. So this is, and this is a big deal, what Asa is doing here. I mean, we can read that over, read past it real quick, saying, oh yeah, that's nice. He got rid of all the perverted persons. That's sweet. But in reality, we've got to think about what that means. I mean, the economy had become dependent on that. This is stuff that was integral within the culture of Judaism at that time. So for him to banish them, for him to stop all of that, well, I mean, he's, there's jobs going to be lost. There's going to be all kinds of impacts on the culture and all the way down the line on an economic level and everything, which shows this is cool. This is Asa's loyalty to God. He doesn't care how much it's going to shake up everything, even on an economic level. And you realize, of course, that by and large, your average Joe isn't going to be real keen about this. What? He shut down what? Where am I going to go after work now or any of that stuff? So, there's going to be even the hearts of the people are going to be angry about this. He's taking a huge risk in this, but his heart is loyal to God. He doesn't care what the cost is. He's going to do what he believes is absolutely right. I mean, there could have been terrible public outcry against this, but his loyalty to God is that same kind of loyalty that David had, because David always put God's will and God's way and God's values first. He didn't go by he didn't take public opinion polls before he did anything, and he did what was necessary in order to follow God. So whatever the cost. And then the other thing that it says that he did was get rid of, it says he removed Ma'akah, his grandmother, from being queen mother. Now, a lot of that's kind of confusing, but because you know, there is no precedent for a queen mother in this sense in the former writings, in the former texts here. There's no official position that we're aware of within the construct of the rule of the king in Judah to have the queen mother. So that's a curiosity, and I'm sure it came from certain pagan influences that had grown up within this period of time. And so, you know, there's no nepotism going on here with Asa. You know, it's not that he's just picking on the guys out there in the temples and stuff. He looks to his own household and he looks at what's going on and he says, no, we're not going to have this anymore. So, I mean, he's, you know, he's giving old granny the boot too. You know, everybody's subject to his reforms. It says that he cut down her obscene image of Asherah and some translations, if you've got a King James, you'll see that it says idol, and there are other translations that say idol there. In the New King James, it says obscene image. The literal Hebrew on that is an obscene image, or actually it means something that is horrible. This is the way it comes across in Strong's, a horrible or a frightening or an abhorrent thing. So whatever it was, and it doesn't, you know, the writer, the narrator doesn't even dignify it with a description, doesn't even tell us what it is, although based on archaeological findings and all associated with these types of ancient religions, we can assume, and many people do assume, and basing it also with Second Chronicles as it talks about the pillars, we believe it was probably some sort of phallic symbol or something along those lines. But, you know, there's no, you know, because it was associated with this cult that this woman, that Granny was associated with. So, you know, that was Granny's cult. And we don't know. I mean, we don't know for sure what it was all about. But when it came to Asa, I mean, this is his grandmother, and he's not gonna give her any concessions or anything like that. He's gonna reform even in house. So, I mean, this is good. This is a very positive thing that we see happening here with the king of Judah. And it says that he took this image down, and to show his utmost contempt for this image, it says that he burned it by the brook Kidron, which means little to us when we just read it. You know, we just say that he burned it by the brook Kidron. Oh, well, that's nice. Lovely. But then when you look at the history of Jerusalem and you understand a little bit about the brook Kidron, which runs through the Kidron Valley, which is to the east side of the east wall of Jerusalem, and to the southeast wall there, right by the brook Kidron in that valley, is the largest garbage dump that Israel had at that time, or the city of Jerusalem had. Later on, it was moved farther to the south in the time of Jesus, and it was referred to as Gehenna. And it was used by the rabbis of Jesus' day as a depiction of what was going to happen in the afterlife for those who refused to obey God or follow his rules. Jesus also followed suit with that and used that as an example of what would happen at the end of a person's life if they refused to follow God and to follow his ways in a final judgment sense. He pointed to that. It was a place where there was, you know, that's a place where they would take desecrated bodies and they would throw them in there. It was a place where animal carcasses would go. It was a place where human waste would go. There were fires that would burn there on a regular basis as they would burn that stuff down and try to make room for more. You know, you think of, we're so used to our world with running water and toilets and plumbing and everything like that. But life was different in those days and in that environment. So that's what Jesus was pointing at, using as an illustration of the end result. You know, we don't know exactly what this looks like. I mean, everybody's got all their different descriptions of, you know, pitchforks and caves with flames and things like that. But Jesus used a garbage dump where there was constant burning and flies and a wretched smell. And he pointed at that and said, that's the end. That's the end for someone who you know, doesn't submit his heart to God. So that's way off the subject, but it's interesting either way. So anyway... It says there that Asa stopped short of removing the high places that were, and the high places, you know, the pagan religions would go up to hills and to high places, to mountaintops, and they would set up altars where they would worship their false gods. And it says that he didn't remove the high places. The only thing is that in 2 Chronicles 14:3, it does say that he does remove the altars of the foreign gods and the high places of the foreign gods within that context. So, we remember that back during Solomon's time, before the temple was built, remember how Israel was going up to the high places to worship God? These were kind of like well, how do we word it? They were kind of like little worshiping God kiosks that were set up in convenient locations on the high places throughout Israel, and people would go there and they would worship God at these high places. They were desiring to worship the one true God of Israel, but they were doing so following a pagan fashion of moving to the high place and worshiping him there. So what scholars believe is since Chronicles says that he does remove the foreign gods, the high places of the foreign gods, it looks like he stopped short of removing the high places that were dedicated to the God of Israel. So, and it's interesting, the text points this out and you get a negative cast from that, don't you? As you're looking at that, you get the sense. Nevertheless, he didn't remove the high places, which I don't know, in and of itself has a certain commentary inherent in it, because God's not so interested in how creative we can get in trying to impress him or to do something for him. He's more interested in how loyal we'll be in obedience to him. God never ordained the Israelites to go to high places. He ordained his altar. He had them build their own type of high place on the altar that was a step up that they were to go to, and it was connected with the worship at the tabernacle and then later transferred over to the temple when it was built. That was what God had ordained. He didn't call Israel to follow suit with the pagan nations around them and worship God on these other high places. And while if you're going to look at it and say in terms of degree in terms of degree of irritation that God seems to have with that, it seems to be lesser than everything else. It doesn't seem to be, you know, a gigantic deal, but it does seem to be something. Nevertheless, he didn't do that. He didn't stop everybody from following these practices that were similar enough to the pagan practices that it leaves the door open for them to slip right back into following those old paths, those paths that weren't established by God. But aside from that, it says that basically Asa was loyal to God in all his days. And he was summarized by his reforms and his restorations. He was summarized in his reforms in that he was removing the idolatrous practices and he was known for restoration in that he was restoring the utensils to the temple worship that were supposed to be the things that God did ordain in terms of the instruments of worship. So reform and restoration, if you think about it, that's exactly what's going on in our lives. I mean, when Jesus comes in and Jesus changes our hearts, when we believe on him, we put our faith in him, we determine, I'm going to follow you. I'm not going to follow my old ways. I'm going to follow you. There's a reform that begins to take place. And I don't mean reforming just our behavior, though that's a part of it, but a reform in terms of the way we used to understand life and the way we understand it now. There's a removal of things that God does. I mean, I've described it that way before. It's like an invasion. The kingdom of heaven comes into our lives, and it's like an invasion that takes place. And we've got all these pockets of resistance left over from the fall in our own lives, and Jesus comes to tear those down. Piece by piece, place by place, he comes to tear down those strongholds. And that's the reform that takes place. And then there's this this recovery that it takes place as well, a restoration of God's original intent for our lives. We become then the people that we were meant to be, the people we were created to be, that we aren't just stumbling through the wreckage of this fall with no meaning or no purpose. We now become those people that God originally designed us to be, the people that not only worship God, but display the glory of his love and his righteousness to the world around us. So that's what happens with us as well. Asa's reforms and restorations become kind of symbolic of that along the way. So then verse 16. Now there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. And Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might let none go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa took all the silver and gold that was left in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's house, and he delivered them into the hand of his servants, and King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon. of Hetzion, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. See, I've sent you a present of silver and gold. Come and break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he'll withdraw from me. So Ben-Hadad heeded King Asa, and he sent captains of his armies against the cities of Israel. He attacked Eion, Dan, and Abel, Beth Ma'akah, and all of Kinneroth, and with all the land of Naphtali. Now it happened when Baasha heard it that he stopped building Ramah and remained in Tirzah. Then King Asa made a proclamation throughout all Judah. None was exempted, and they took away the stones and timber of Ramah, which Baasha had used for building, and with them King Asa built Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. The rest of the acts of Asa, all his might and all he did, and the cities which he built, aren't they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? But in the time of his old age, he was diseased in his feet. So Asa rested with his father. He was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. And then Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his place. Okay, you may be confused by now. As you know, you read something like this, and at least for me, you know, you look at this and say, well, who's Baasha? Where'd this guy come from? And we're going to find out in a little bit. Remember, we're reading an ancient Eastern document that didn't carry with it the sensibilities that we have as Westerners who like everything in a chronological order. That didn't seem to matter that much to them, and so we're going to kind of jump out of order here, and we'll come back to who Baasha is and how he got into his position here in just a minute. But right at this moment, we see that there's a conflict that's brewing between Asa and Baasha, who is now presently the king of the 10 northern tribes in Israel. And he presses his struggle for dominance over this territory here by building what is essentially a blockade just outside of the territory of Judah. It's the main route that would allow travelers, merchants, and everyone to be able to move in and out of Judean territory freely. So this, in effect, in essence, what he does here, what he's doing is mounting a siege. I mean, this is nothing less than a siege that he's done. He's gone down here, built a fortified, or a fortress. He's gone down and built a fortress right on the property line, so to speak. And they're working on this, and clearly we see that the tides have turned, the scales have tipped in the favor of the northern kingdoms, because Asa can't mount any kind of counteroffensive without help. He's got to seek help somewhere else. He's got to look to his allies for some sort of help in getting an upper hand in this situation. So he empties out his piggy bank and he goes to buy the favor of the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad. So what they do, he agrees to it. Clearly he had a lot in the piggy bank, and so he agrees to it, and he breaks the treaty that he had with Israel, the king of Syria does, and moving towards the north and the cities that are in the northern regions there, he begins mounting attacks. And as soon as Baasha, the king of Israel, hears about these attacks, he's got to withdraw his troops and his men from building the siege fortress and move them in to defend the other areas. It's a very tactically sound maneuver on the southern kingdom's part. And so he sends out an order as soon as the coast is clear, and they all run out there, you know, scurry out, bada, utini, and they run out and they tear the whole thing down and dispose of it so that they don't have this siege or this blockade going on anymore. What's interesting is according to 2 Chronicles chapter 16, this is a bad move on Asa's part. There's a prophet who comes to Asa, and you'll read that on your own if you want to at some time. We'll get there when we get there. But a prophet comes to Asa and warns him not to do this, says that you shouldn't have done this. You shouldn't have gone to the king of Syria to look for help. And then he begins to utter this thing, and you get a glimpse into God's heart in the process of it, because he's saying to him, you should have gone to the God of Israel. And he makes that statement, I'm sure you've heard it before, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro, looking for those who'll trust him so that he can reveal himself to be powerful on behalf of those who'll trust him. So God was disappointed, clearly, that it comes across in this situation that Asa, for all of his loyalties, for all the reforms and all the things that he did, when it came to this political situation and when it came to this military tactical situation that he didn't know what to do with, instead of seeking the Lord, he went and did what was Well, it was a good move. I mean, on a practical level, on a purely pragmatic level, it was a good move. It was a smart move on his behalf, but it wasn't the right move. And you know, that even teaches us some things that we can look things over and figure out the most logical way to go. But if we have a warning from the Lord, if we have a direction from God that it's to go another way, or if it's in some way going to violate what the Word of God has revealed, then it's not going to be the right way. It doesn't matter how great it may look on the surface, it's not the right way to go. And for Asa, it wasn't his way. He wasn't supposed to go this way. But Asa does this terrible thing. And like I said, you can read about that in Chronicles, but does this terrible thing that when the prophet says this to him, instead of being struck in the heart, here he'd been loyal to God all this time, instead of repenting and saying, "Oh God, I'm so sorry. What did I do here? Forgive me for that." He gets angry with the messenger. He gets mad at the prophet and he throws him in jail. And so it's kind of a negative type of thing in the closing days of Asa's life and of his rule. And so in direct correlation, you know, if we put these things together in direct correlation with this act of pride on his part, it says that when he was old, he was diseased in his feet and he died. And there's all kinds of speculations as to what that could mean, because, you know, it's not that often that, you know, smelly feet make you die. I've come close to it before when I pulled my socks off, but it's, you know, I haven't seen it actually go all the way to death's door like that. But some have suggested maybe, you know, that there were complications with sores or ulcers on his feet that led to gangrene or things like that. You know, who knows? I mean, some have said gout, but there again, gout is not necessarily something that's common to that region because of the climate, and it's not common to that to perish within 2 years because of gout. So it could have been diabetes, yeah, the same type of thing, where an ulcerated sore, that a lesion that came from diabetes, could have led to gangrene. Either way, the context of it is, and it's interesting that in the Second Chronicles passage, it says that in his disease, he didn't seek the Lord, but he sought the physicians. And of course, that's not saying that he shouldn't have gone to the doctor. What it's saying is that instead of looking at what was happening in his life and asking himself, is God trying to get my attention? Should I have not thrown that prophet in jail? Instead, he just looked for temporal relief at the moment and said, you know, get me okay from this. And he didn't factor in God's part in all of this thing. He didn't factor in what God was doing in the bigger picture. He was refusing God's correction, even in that. And so that's why he ends up perishing. So in some ways, I mean, it's too bad. I mean, he started so well with all that he was doing, and yet there seems to be such a negative tone to this at the end of it. And you get the sense that over time, you know, position and power and pride took its toll on him, and his heart began to harden over time. And that's, again, we come back to, it's the issue of the heart. Our hearts above all things. We got to guard our hearts that we don't allow the effects of this culture and this world around us to begin to poison our understanding and our worldview and our perspective on what's really important. Because ultimately, when it comes down to what's really important, we're going to slice that down to a very few things that are important. And really, you could bring it down to one thing that's important, and that is how our heart is tied to the Lord our God, because that's the thing that's going to carry us through eternity. That's the thing that's going to matter when it's all said and done. All right, verse 25. Now, Nadab, okay, so let me just give you a real quick, it's kind of like, we're going to rewind just a little bit here, and we're going to go up to the northern kingdom and see what was going on up there, and where this guy Baasha came from. So, verse 25, now Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. And he reigned over Israel 2 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he walked in the way of his father. And in his sin by which he had made Israel sin, then Baasha, the son of the house of Issachar, conspired against him, and Baasha killed him at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, while Nadab and all Israel laid siege to Gibbethon. Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. And it was so when he became king that he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He didn't leave one to Jeroboam. He didn't leave to Jeroboam anyone, rather, that breathed until he had destroyed him, according to the word which he had spoken by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. And that's a different Ahijah than the other one over there. This is the prophet that they're speaking of here. Verse 30, because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he had sinned, and by the way which he had made Israel sin, because of his provocation with which he had provoked the Lord God of Israel to anger. Now the rest of the acts of Nadab and all that he did, aren't they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. So, here we get the history of what was going on there. You know, we had the successor to Rehoboam, who only lasted for 3 years, and then Asa came in, and it says there that the second year that Asa was king, Nadab, the successor, and the son in order, ready to reign, took the throne after Jeroboam passed away. But he assumes the same idolatry and sin that his father was involved in. There's no reforms. We don't see anything going on like we see going on down in the southern kingdom with Asa. And so this guy, Baasha, assassinates him, and he destroys the whole family, which ends up fulfilling the prophecy that was made against him. You know, here's one of these issues where God reveals his sovereignty. I believe God is in control of all things. And here he's using one wicked man to kill another wicked man. I don't believe that God is making them do anything. I don't believe that anybody's doing anything that they don't want to do. I don't think Baasha was going, oh, I got to go kill this guy, and I really don't want to do it, but it's God's will. I think that these are guys that are doing what they want to do. God is using that, though, using the conditions that he's given, the fallen conditions of this world, to ultimately accomplish his own purposes, and that is going to be the redemption of all mankind who believe on him. So this all is fulfilled exactly the way God said it was going to be fulfilled. Verse 33, in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, became king over all Israel in Tirzah and reigned 24 years. And that's a long time. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He walked the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had made Israel to sin. So again, he's no better. He comes in and replaces the family line of Jeroboam in terms of physical family genealogies, but spiritually, he's still Jeroboam's child. Spiritually, he continues on in the same kind of corruption that they were involved in. And so we are seeing now, in these past few chapters, we have seen now the northern kingdom in its departure from the southern kingdom has now slipped into what is essentially going to be the second dark age of Israel. The first dark ages occurred right after they came into the promised land, and all Israel did what was right in his own eyes. And now, under the leadership of kings, they're following the same patterns that they fell into before. So this is going to be a dark time for the nation of Israel to the north, and it'll be hard to see, but we'll learn some lessons as we go through it. So Father, we thank you for your word, and we thank you for what you reveal to us in it. And Lord, we just pray that our hearts are awakened as we read your word and as we recognize and realize the importance of having our heart knit to your heart, as we see over and over in the word what's happened and what it is that you desire, what you long for more than anything else, is to capture our hearts and to fulfill in us the destiny that you originally intended, that we would radiate your glory, that we would reveal your love and your character and your values. So lead us into that, Father. Help us and enable us to allow you in your conquest to take over everything and leave nothing to us, Lord. Have it all, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.